This is the fourth and last tape of the conversation with Judge Hasty. Continue.
Well, we can. It doesn't matter about our voices anyway, just so we get the words in this. We're not singing. Let's see, where were we? Oh, yes. There's a related question to the matter of history. I'll read you another quotation.
Yes.
Related. If Negroes are to claim the past that is rightfully theirs, they will have to assume the risks that go with a past. Acquisition of a past is necessary, but also perilous, for it means an end to innocence. Just as the Negro past shows beauty and grandeur, so it also shows human meanness, cruelty, and injustice. The Europeans, after all, did not invent the slave trade. They stimulated a commerce that Africans had carried on since time immemorial. And so on, that
yes,
line.
Yeah.
Now you find occasionally this, say Lomax, one of Lomax's books, when the white man went to Africa to seize the slaves, he accepts part of his history but not all of it.
Yes, your tribe part of the economy of tribal war was to seize the adversary, vanquished adversary, and sell him into slavery, unquestionably.
But the whole picture, do you recognize this problem of a risk of the past in the new self-consciousness of Negroes of their history? A failure to recognize the risk?
Perhaps I don't recognize it as much as I should. Because in my limited capacity of perspective, I think we're so far short of developing a really great pride of African ancestry. Also, I think that since during the generations of slavery, a century roughly of major slavery, the slaves were torn away from that tradition. And tradition is not something one builds with a few textbooks and books. I don't see now a great danger of the Negro developing an arrogance of race. I think the likelihood is that he develops a will to be assimilated in American culture as distinguished from an arrogance as African. And if I am right about that, while the possibility is there, I don't believe the danger is a very great one.
Outside of the black Muslims, of course. That
Yes.
You raise a question there that is very important to some Negroes, at least some tell me this is important to them, the question of attention, a split in the psyche, which Du Bois wrote about quite often, between the pull toward what is now, you know, the African mystique, or negritude, or the even the Negro tradition in America, as distinguished from Western European culture, the Christian, Judeo-Christian tradition, or Americanism. A real split, which was for some, like Du Bois, was a real problem, a fundamental problem, which you never resolved until the very end,
yes.
I suppose. And for some people, and some people now say this is a real problem, I'm torn. The risk of losing my identity in the white race and in white culture, or at least having my grandchildren lose their identity in the white race and the white culture. Is this significant to you, may I ask? Do you feel this as an issue?
I think it's an issue. Perhaps I see it in somewhat different perspective.
Well, please tell me about that.
I see this building up of a pride in blackness, a special pride in African tradition, as filling a vacuum created by a sense of denial of a sharing in the pride of contemporary America, in the history of our own country. And I have a feeling that as Negroes increasingly have an opportunity to really feel that they are a part of America and the American tradition, that their preference will be to that source of pride and identification. And I think you can test that with the increasing group of young Negroes now who are having first educational opportunities, then economic opportunities outside of the Negro community itself, who take a pride in their American identification, but without any sense of shame because of their racial identification. Now, I realize that there are all too many who still don't have that opportunity.
Yes.
And this special pride in race and in racial background and tradition, perhaps for a long time, will be an essential thing to the building of the ego. But I believe it will be a decreasing rather than an increasing thing if we look at a 50 years ahead.
There's some tendency among various, you might say, types of Negroes, as far as I can make out and I'm told, to resent the, shall we say, Negro success, that is, the Negro who makes a professional or business or intellectual success and is not officially committed to some program of militant development of Negro position. The most most recent instance of this is the attacks on Ralph Ellison because he has kept on just being a novelist, though his novels are certainly clear enough as far as in terms of his attitude, he says novel is in his story sense, part of the new novel. Well, you see what I mean? This sort of from the uneducated and the poor and the deprived, on up through people who have elected to be officially Negro militants.
Yes.
Now, not to make it personal, I mean a person like you is outside of that, or a person like a Negro scientist, or a Negro doctor, or Ralph Ellison, who stand outside of official organizations devoted to Negro advancement. This special kind of leadership from the outside, from the periphery, from personal achievement. Quite violently.
Yes.
As you do, no doubt have encountered in certain ways.
Yes.
How much of a problem is this? Do you think this is a real significant or just ordinary little human, garden variety trouble along the way?
I have several comments. First of all, it's not peculiar to the Negro. There is resentment in the overall society, and I think properly so, directed toward the individual who has been personally successful in an economic way. and does not have an active concern for the problems of the disadvantaged. So in that aspect, I think it's an inevitable and resentment that I would be entirely, that I sympathize with, that Negroes who are disadvantaged resent Negroes as well as perhaps more than whites who have achieved personal advantage and are not willing to devote to their time and effort and substance to helping their disadvantaged brethren. Now, in that aspect, I think it's there, it's inevitable, and I certainly don't criticize it. Now, on the other hand, again, whether we are dealing with Negroes or whites or any group, there inevitably is a certain amount of human jealousy of success, and human jealousy is reflected in overt resentments of various sorts. So both of those aspects I think are real and important.
The question of betrayal is a little bit different again. The person who's betrayed his obligation to fight for, you know.
Yes.
That Ellis too.
Well, they're more in the past than today. There certainly have been, and still are some Negroes, who use their positions of some eminence or success to persuade their brethren to be patient, to recognize that in God's good time wrongs will be righted, and so on. Some Negro during the days before the abolition of slavery, I think, came out with the expression, "Be still and kiss the rod." That sort of advice.
Yeah.
That has always been resented, always will be, and I think always should be resented. And of course, in some cases, it's sheer selfish personal advantage of people who feel that they can improve their own position in the society or the economic community indicating to whites that they can exercise an effective restraining influence upon other Negroes. But the interesting change in the Negro community in the last 20 years, certainly, is that very few Negroes feel that they can effectively maintain that posture, because they become so quickly and outspokenly disavowed by Negroes generally, that they are no longer recognized in the white community as being effective in some measure of control over the Negro community.
He can't deliver the vote anymore.
No, so you find the most conservative Negroes today taking public positions far more outspoken than what Negroes considered radical 30 years ago would take.
Some are forced into it and some are sincerely accepting
Correct.
It. But
correct.
What lies behind a thing like Dawson's trouble in Chicago? He's a politician of long, long success. And
I don't know. I'm far removed from the Chicago scene, though at one time I knew something of it. I would just suspect there are numbers of things. There comes a time in any dominant one man or small group of men political control when people, including prospective leaders, become restive and want to throw off that control. There's also the effect that throughout this period of Congressman Dawson's political dominance in Chicago, many Negroes see aspects of their community life and position getting worse rather than better. So it's in that sense a rejection of leadership, which in the broad social view is seen as having failed.
Let me read you a little card here of these questions. There is a danger that in a newfound militancy, Negroes may become the victims of their own rhetoric. Negro leaders have already shown a tendency to react to labels rather than substance. Once a proposal is called soft or moderate, one feels obliged to attack it without regard to the merits of the case. In the fall of 1963, many Negro leaders attacked Kennedy for opposing the strong, quotes, and supporting the weak version of civil rights. But before the House Judiciary Committee, yet the strong version was in some ways much weaker when called strong. For example, it omitted the creation of federal registrars to ensure Negro voting rights. And so on. This is developed in some other documents.
Tyranny of labels and characterizations that analytically don't mean what they say is, I think, characteristic of all social struggle. It's characteristic of political struggle. If one succeeds in giving a particular label that has a bad connotation to a candidate, that candidate loses votes, even though analytically or in fact his position does not deserve that characterization. Therefore, it becomes a test of the skill of leadership to avoid as much as possible the adverse label and to win the socially attractive label to his program.
We're back to symbolism again then, aren't we?
We're back to symbolism. In the American scene, one of the striking examples of success in that is the leadership of Puerto Rico, which has been in the party headed by Governor Muñoz Marín, which has been in power throughout 20 years or more in Puerto Rico, and has managed to maintain the popular image of itself as forward-looking, uncompromising, while at the same time carrying forward a statesmanlike program as contrasted with the program of the minority, for example, which has said independence now and nothing else. There is a problem of social and political tactics there that is a very, very difficult one. And sometimes leadership has been impaled on a slogan, and that will continue to be a problem.
You know the various interpretations of the phrase, the debt to the Negro, this notion in its most extreme form, it's payment and back wages. Now you people take it that way, you see, for how many hundred years, you know. In other forms is Whitney Young's notion of the crash program for the underprivileged Negro. And in other forms is a question of preferential treatments in various ways. Now, how can we distinguish any level of this notion of the debt to the Negro from the debt society owes to any underprivileged person whose parents are also underprivileged and on back, say, in the highlands of Kentucky now, in the dead coal country of West Virginia? Can we distinguish this one kind of debt from the other?
And logically, I think we can't. We cannot make, or analytically, we cannot make such a distinction. The Negro is perhaps the largest identifiable national group as to which this concept is conveniently applied. Also, this debt concept relates to 100 years of slavery, which in a sense is in the public mind a special kind of debt because it relates to the most grievous sort of deprivation. I think basically, again, here is something that is a useful symbol in social struggle. As a real justification for a particular program, I would certainly concede that there is the same justification for a program of assisting any and all of the underprivileged in our society.
Some people go so far as to see nothing but danger in a preferential program for Negroes which ignored the needs of other poor and underprivileged.
Danger, I'm not sure.
In building
danger,
up resistance. Building up resistance.
Oh, yeah, and building up resistance in the white community.
Among the poor and the privileged whites.
Yes. Well, there certainly, let's take preferential hiring as a particular thing. There certainly is a grave danger in preferential hiring in a static or contracting economy. I doubt whether there is a grave danger in an economy that's expanding as rapidly as ours is, and hopefully is going to be, say, in the next decade. If our total unemployed labor force, employable unemployed labor force, is, say, substantially under 5%, while the underemployment of Negroes is very much higher, I don't believe the social impact of preferential employment for Negroes on the white community as a whole is going to be serious. Now, I'm not speaking of the morality of it now or the justification, but I'm talking about how people will react to it. And in that respect, of course, I must agree with those who feel that expanding national economy, the rapidly expanding national economy, is a fundamental thing in any program of improving the economy of the Negro within our national order.
Quota and preferential treatments are quite different, though, in their in the application, even in a contracting economy or a stagnant economy, aren't they? You can justify a quota approach, but you can't justify a preferential, isn't that right?
Well, I'm not sure that the two are different except in degree.
They are different in degree, but the degree...
A quota is preferential, but it's a limited preference.
It's preferential only if the Negro is not as well equipped for the job, though, isn't it?
Right.
If he's well equipped, it's not preferential for the quota.
The unspoken premise of what I was saying is that for reasons that we need not go into in detail now, for a time at least, you're going to find large numbers of Negro applicants for employment that in one way or another are not as well equipped as some white applicants. Now, you certainly will find numbers of persons in a given situation who are adequately prepared for certain training and employment. And yet within that group, some who are not as well prepared as others. Now, whenever you pass over the number one person in the group of those who can adequately do the job in favor of the number two or the number 20, whether it's done to achieve quota or to achieve a preferential scheme, it is individually unfair to the number one man. And the number one man and others are unquestionably going to have resentment of that. But my point was merely that in the expanding economy, that problem is not so acute, if only because there is going to be opportunity for the best of the people in the group, regardless of race.
Anyway, they'll make it.
Yep, right.
That's a tough question, though, isn't it?
It's a very tough problem, and unquestionably, there is a bad reaction in the general community if the impression is abroad that what the Negro wants is not justice, but opportunity beyond his merits.
Not his moral merits, but his merely accidental personal merits,
right,
based on his misfortunes of the past, even.
Right.
The South and the economy, problem of maintaining or developing an expanding economy at a greater rate than we now have it. One of the big things is simply an enormous program of education and training, isn't it, for both the whites and Negroes?
Of course it is. So that, of course, being the result of the kind of economy that we're developing in the second half of the 20th century.
I mean, new technology, for one thing.
Surely.
But that gets mislaid in the discussion very often, doesn't it?
Yes, but I think it is being increasingly realized in the Negro community. Here in Philadelphia, there is a considerable, or a great, headlines are being attracted by a small but rather ambitious project sponsored by a large group of Negro ministers and assisted by the Chamber of Commerce and business leaders and so on, for a privately developed program of training of Negroes for industry who at the present time lack the skills for the jobs that that are available. And while the size of the program is not such in itself to make real impact, it does represent a major emphasis originating in the Negro community upon this aspect of the problem.
How well are you acquainted with the, what is it called, the Woodlawn Project in Chicago?
Really know it only by name and very limited reading.
Afraid we are winding us up. Let's take. This is the end of the fourth tape and the end of the conversation with Judge Hasty, April 20, 1963.